Back when I was a circus clown with a tent show, there was a guy called the Arrow Man. His job was to tack up paper signs with red arrows printed on them all along the route to the next town, so the performers and crew could find their way. This fellow did his job very well. He never made a mistake. And he really secured those signs. Even in the worst weather, the red arrows could be seen flapping from light posts and exit ramps, bedraggled and torn, but always there, a tattered assurance to all concerned that they were on the right track. Despite his excellent record, there were times I doubted the Arrow Man. Not on the well-posted hops between neighboring towns or within big cities, but on the long hauls, over flat, featureless plains and twisting mountain roads, whenever there were scores of miles between pointers. And sometimes, that doubt got the better of me. I'd turn off the highway, looking for local assurance. Eventually, a rusty gas pump tended by a wizened elder named Slim, Buzz, or Junior would come into view. After absorbing my request for guidance, Slim, Buzz, Junior would squint, spit, wipe his hands on an oily rag, and always say the same thing, "Son, it's the next exit." And sure enough, the next exit would be festooned with red arrows. In a career that's careened from circus clowning to shadow puppetry to picture books, early off-ramps have been a great temptation. Sometimes there weren't any red arrows. Other times, the road disappeared. But here's a terrific indication that despite numerous detours and stop signs, I'm on the right track. Being awarded the Caldecott Medal for Golem is a wonderful honor, and I'm very grateful for it. It's much prettier than a beat-up red arrow, and the people who give it are so classy. At dinner tonight, not one of them used an oily rag, squinted, or even spat. After the announcement, many people asked me if I was excited. I was, but the initial burst soon dimmed. As more folks inquired, I began to wonder if I was excited enough. Then I realized, yes, of course you are. It had simply transformed to a steadier, more quiet glow, just as satisfying, but easier to sustain. My wife Donna and I have been self-employed in the arts for almost 20 years. We've managed to maintain a steady upward course despite changes, challenges, disappointments, and victories. It helps to keep good things in perspective as much as bad. Donna is excellent at this. One time at home, she took a breathless call from a teacher totally undone by the fact that we answer our telephone like all other mortals. "Is this where David Wisniewski lives?" she queried. "Yes," Donna replied. "Oh my," said the teacher. "Are you his secretary?" "No," said Donna. "I'm his wife." "Gracious," said the teacher. "That must be so exciting," Donna said, occasionally. Another reason for perspective is that I'm still new at this, in a lot of ways. Yes, Golem is my sixth book, but it, and all the others, have been achieved without standard training. As a self-taught artist and writer, I rely on instincts, developed through years of circus and puppet performance, to guide a story's structure and look. It's worked well so far, but there's still plenty to learn. At least I don't doubt the outcome as much as I used to. When my first effort, The Warrior and the Wise Man, got great reviews, I said to Donna, "Gee, I hope they don't find out that I'm not a real writer." But the greatest rationale for perspective concerns the nature of awards. The Caldecott Medal, like all other honors, isn't a glorious destination. It's a glorious indication, brightly marking a turning point on a continuing course. Gold rather than red, metal instead of paper, it serves the same purpose, albeit in much grander terms, as those weathered signs that guided me across the country earlier. Cheering as it was to spot those red arrows, I didn't pull over, set out a deck chair, and wave to the show from the median strip. The boss wouldn't have liked it. It's still not a good idea, because now the editors wouldn't like it. Treating the Caldecott as an end in itself would mean the journey's over and complete, and my goodness, there's still an awful lot to do. Backstage at Ringling Brothers, I overheard a reporter question Gunther Gable Williams, the animal trainer who headlined the show for decades, about his energetic performances and nonstop training schedule. "Don't you ever relax?" she asked. Gunther looked at her as though she had three heads. "You can relax when they throw dirt in your face," he replied. I take a similar attitude toward book illustration. Actually, with my obsessive-compulsive art style, I have no choice. It's the only way to meet a deadline within the decade specified by the publisher. Though demanding, making words and pictures fit and flow in narrative harmony is enormously satisfying. Few other professions are as metaphysical. The thoughts and images of one mind are transformed into a solid object, which, when opened, conveys them to thousands of other minds. What a privilege. What an opportunity. What a responsibility. That's why I enjoy epic tales. There's so much to them. Huge canvases teeming with character, adventure, and romance, which, when flung back, reveal an equally luxuriant superstructure of history and culture. When properly balanced, epics operate like enormous machines, with the thoughts and actions of individual characters meshing with the giant gears of society and civilization in perfect synchronization. And they take you places. When I was a kid, I remember so well being transported by big stories. The first was in first grade, Dr. Seuss's McGonagall's Pond, an undersea tale of bizarre creatures that had me gazing suspiciously at puddles and bathtubs for months. Comic books came next, sometimes short on character, but with enough interplanetary upset to make up for it. These were followed by classic comics, simplified graphic versions of novels by Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, and H.G. Wells, inspiring me to tackle the densely printed pages of the real things later on. By fourth grade, I was a regular commuter to other worlds. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, A Journey to the Center of the Earth, The War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, and everything ever written by Ray Bradbury, Robert Heinlein, and J.R.R. Tolkien. So I figure that if I'm going to lavish all this time and energy designing a ticket, it should take the buyer someplace worthwhile. The first ingredient in constructing that someplace is language. The words must serve the world of the story. And because that world is other than our own, the words seldom have the comfortable cadence and vocabulary of contemporary English. Sometimes that causes complaint. "Why do you use such big words?" some students and teachers ask. Actually, the words aren't so much big as underused. On that basis, they can be unfamiliar. I'm not a fan of using big words when little ones will do. However, as a culture, we're rather lazy with language. Lack of variety and imprecision abound. Books are the last repository of specific language. So, when a more exotic word refines a phrase or adds subtlety and grace to a sentence, I'll give it the nod over its more common cousin. The second ingredient is mission. The characters must engage in something that matters greatly to them and to the family, village, clan, or nation they love and are part of. The execution of this mission forces the characters into a conflict, which, to resolve, demands they stand, if not on their own resources, on principles beyond themselves. Then, if I've adequately humanized the characters in the few broad strokes allowed within the text limits of a picture book, the readers will not only willingly suspend disbelief, but give the story their heart. They will invest themselves emotionally. An author cannot be granted a greater gift than this. When creating this emotional fulcrum, I often think of an excerpt from Percy Bysshe Shelley's Prometheus Unbound, a piece committed to memory for its simple and majestic reasoning. "To suffer woes which hope thinks infinite, to forgive wrongs darker than death or night, to defy power which seems omnipotent, neither to change, nor falter, nor repent. This is to be good, great and joyous, beautiful and free. This is alone life, joy, empire, and victory. This thought has powered all my books. At one point, I got concerned about it. I asked my excellent editor, Dinah Stevenson, if I was writing the same story all the time and just changing the character's clothes. She replied, no. The individual against great odds is one of the great themes of literature, and you can spin endless variations off a theme. And besides that, I would be the first to tell you if you were repeating yourself. The final ingredient is the happy ending. Not for its own sake and the pleasant conclusion of a comfortable tale, but because a principle has been called into action, and that principle must prove itself. Life has laws, and these laws of life must stand by the one who requested their assistance as truly and faithfully as the one willing to sacrifice everything for their aid. Of course, one might reasonably say, well then, you really blew it with Golem. There's no happy ending there. On the contrary, there is. The persecution of the Jews of Prague ended, at least for a time, and the community survived. But this triumph is deeply shaded by sacrifice, the melancholy demise of the clay giant who was the flawed instrument of their salvation. In his wonderful essay, On Fairy Stories, J.R.R. Tolkien writes, "The joy of the happy ending does not deny the existence of sorrow and failure. The possibility of these is necessary to the joy of deliverance. It denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, universal final defeat, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief." I regard striving for and transmitting these glimpses of joy to be the highest calling of this profession. It's for this reason that a Japanese sage is awarded the kingdom when wisdom overrules force, that a blind Viking girl's bravery regains her stolen vision, that a Maya ball player's skill saves his people from disaster, that a prince of Mali overcomes overwhelming odds to lead an empire, that a desperate rabbi successfully calls upon divine salvation. And it's also the reason for the Caldecott, to point beyond the walls of the world, to wrest attention away from the extraordinary hustle and bustle of everyday life in order to acquaint an eager audience with the quiet beauty of a book. A book that for the duration of its spell may provide a fleeting glimpse of an existence more pure and powerful than the one we presently know. I've had a lot of help achieving these stories. The greatest has been and continues to be for my wife, Donna, whose loving support has been constant even when I didn't deserve it. This honor is hers. I want to thank Dillis Evans, the Resolute Artists representative who was gracious enough to look at a fledgling artist's meager portfolio 10 years ago and say, why not? Give it a go. And who has been a source of great encouragement and advice ever since. Dorothy Briley of Clarion Books has my great gratitude for agreeing with Dillis Evans and giving an untried artist a chance. Dinah Stevenson, editor extraordinaire, has been instrumental in refining 6 books of my words and pictures with the fiery red of her flashing pencil. My deep appreciation for your grand sense of story and unwavering eye for composition. Thanks are also due art director Ann Diebel, production supervisor Andy Stern, photographer Lee Salisbury, and the indefatigable staff at Berryville Graphics. And, of course, thank you to the members of the 1997 Caldecott Committee for choosing Golem.